3 days, hundreds of thousands of children. The complex plan to vaccinate the youngest Palestinians in Gaza against the highly contagious polio virus.
I'm not going to say this is the ideal way forward, but this is a workable way forward. Not doing anything would be really bad. We have to stop this transmission in Gaza, and we have to avoid the transmission outside Gaza.
Could this be the last chance for Israel and Hamas to reach a ceasefire agreement?
If that opportunity is missed, and the loved ones of these Israeli citizens and internationals as well, we must remember, are essentially left to die, that legacy is going to be with us for a very long time.
And the growing risks journalists face working to bring truth and information in places with leaders determined to silence the press. Today is Saturday, August 31st. Join us as we explore the issues in the news. Hi, everyone. I'm Lori London in Washington. The UN is about to begin a massive campaign to vaccinate some 640,000 children under the age of 10 in Gaza against polio, a disease they fear is now sweeping the strip because of Israel's continued offensive there. Julie Frankel with the Associated Press has details.
The UN says that all parties have agreed to pause combat for the duration of the vaccination campaign, but challenges remain to how it will be implemented. Gaza's road network is 65% destroyed, according to the UN. Hospitals are badly damaged, and children are located in isolated parts of the strip that are really hard to reach. Still, what we know is that there will be 400 fixed sites, hospitals, medical treatment centers where people can get vaccinated, and 200 outreach sites, community centers where people can also bring their kids to get vaccinated. The campaign is supposed to start Sunday, with children lining up for their first of two doses of the vaccine. About 1.3 million doses are already inside Gaza in cold chain storage in a warehouse in the central strip. Now, whatever happens with the vaccination campaign, the pause in fighting is sure to be a welcome reprieve for the people of Gaza who've now weathered 11 months of fighting.
That was Julie Frankel with the Associated Press. The vaccination campaign comes after reports of the first confirmed polio case in Gaza in a 10-month-old who is now paralyzed in his lower left leg. Dr. Mike Ryan, Deputy Director General and Executive Director of the World Health Organization's Health Emergencies Program, says the polio outbreak is occurring with a much larger public health catastrophe.
As of the 25th of August, only 44% of 132 primary health care facilities are functioning. Only 17 out of 36 hospitals are providing services. And these are only partially functioning.
The WHO says it will need to vaccinate at least 90% of the children in Gaza for the campaign to succeed, as it faces huge challenges in the largely destroyed Palestinian enclave. While the polio vaccination campaign is taking place, the Israeli army continued its major operation in the occupied West Bank, where smoke could be seen from the city of Jenin on Friday. It's one of the largest assaults in the Israeli-occupied territory in months. More from Associated Press correspondent Charles de Ledesma.
Israel's conducted an airstrike in Jenin amid days of heavy fighting in the Palestinian territory, the West Bank. The military said in a brief statement that an aircraft struck a terrorist cell during an encounter with security forces in a counter-terrorism operation. It did not immediately elaborate. Such airstrikes, while common over the months-long Israel-Hamas war in the Gaza Strip, have been rare in the West Bank in the time since. Israel says the raids across the area, which have killed at least 16 people since late Tuesday, are aimed at preventing attacks. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
John Linden, Executive Director with the Alliance for Middle East Peace, joins us now to get a better understanding of what is happening and why now.
I mean, it's the confluence of several factors that existed before October 7th, but like so much of the pre-existing conditions before this war, everything has become accelerated and worsened due to the war. So over the last 3.5 years, really, there's been kind of increasing lawlessness, I suppose, in the north of the West Bank. So the PA has lost some of its security control over some key refugee camps in those cities and some of the cities themselves, and Jenin being the real focus. I mean, before October 7th, the largest operation we'd seen in a West Bank city for 2 decades happened in Jenin. in July of last year, with the IDF going in with sort of, you know, heavy armored equipment for the first time in decades. So all of this was kind of, that tinder was already there. The other factor, of course, is the settler violence, which has been increasing again over the last 3 years. And then finally, the radical increase of weapons in the West Bank. It's something that's really apparent in these kind of increasingly ungoverned spaces in the north of the West Bank. It's really not uncommon to see people walking around with assault rifles. And that's something that I very rarely witnessed in the West Bank over the last couple of decades, but it's something you do see in those places. So all of that, you know, you could have said much of the same on October 6th. And then I suppose what's happened since is just this radical increase in Israel's willingness to use extreme force, you know, from their sense of justification being the attack that happened on October 7th, and a much lower risk tolerance, I would guess, than might have existed beforehand. But, you know, there's other means available. And one thing that, you know, was, I think, disturbing about some comments that came from Israeli cabinet ministers in recent days is really using the paradigm of war, saying this is a war in the West Bank. I mean, that's a category error, in my view. There is certainly a war going on right now with Gaza and Israel. It has been that way for 10 months. But Israel has been militarily occupying the West Bank for almost six decades. And it's absurd to suggest that we're now entering a war with forces in the West Bank, where Israel has overall military control. It can enter anywhere in the West Bank at will. And that has been the case for a very long time. And, you know, the frustration, just to be very blunt, is that we've had six decades almost of that status quo, and Israelis and Palestinians are more insecure today than they ever have been. And yet there seems to be a feeling that simply the application of more force, whether it's coming from these militias in the West Bank or from Israel itself, is the way that they will satisfy their security or self-determination needs. And it's very frustrating, because we can just see that that's the pattern that's been repeated for so long, and that's got us to this nadir. And it's, I don't know, for me, self-evident that we need different tools and techniques based on diplomacy and engagement. Because we've reached a dead end via the application of force.
And it just seems sort of, one week we are concerned about, and potentially could still be, an Iran retaliatory attack on Israel that they've promised that could come at any time or not, but it would seem more likely that it'll be when it's not expected. Is this a distraction? And how is this really connected to what's happening in Gaza? It seems like every week it's something different, but the war in Gaza continues. And is this connected?
I'm not sure I see a connection. I mean, there's a case being made that the influx of weapons in the West Bank, which has been a real thing over recent years, that there is some sort of relationship between the Islamic Republic of Iran and smuggling networks over the border with Jordan. And I'm sure there is some of that happening. And we do know that Hamas and Palestinian Islamic Jihad are relatively strong in the northern West Bank, and they obviously have connections with Iran as well. So I think there are certainly people in the security sector in Israel who see sort of this West Bank front, Gaza, everything really, Yemen, the threat from the north, is all being part of this larger sort of shadow war with Iran, the head of the octopus, as they say it. And again, there is definitely truth to that. But there is also this, you know, long-running dispute and war is the wrong word, conflict with the Palestinians for over a century that precedes the establishment of the Islamic Republic of Iran, and if Iran disappeared tomorrow morning, would still be there, right? So I feel like there's a little bit of displacement going on, and I don't undermine in any way the very real security concerns with regards to Iran and the threat that they present to Israel and to the region. But, you know, even just from a military perspective, and I spoke to somebody on Wednesday who's fairly well connected in sort of the Israeli security sector, who made this case as well, there's a limit to what Israel can do. And that limit isn't discussed often enough, right? So we have the largest reserve call-up in the state's history that's been going on now for 10 months. The reserves are exhausted. They've been deployed in Gaza for such a long time. This is, you know, on the way to becoming the longest war in Israel's history. It's already the longest since 1948. And there is, as you mentioned, this threat, like at any moment, we could have a much bigger war between Israel and Hezbollah. And then, of course, there's the threat from Iran and the direct attacks that we saw back in April. And I think sober analysts need to look at this and say, you know what, we're not able to fight this multi-front war ad infinitum. And certainly if that's the only tool that we have to be able to take care of Israel's security needs, it's not sustainable over the long term. For Israel to remain sort of, you know, an OECD sort of developed democracy whilst fighting that intensity of warfare. Now, I think Israel will do it if it has to do it. I'm not in any way trying to undermine the determination, I guess, in some way, of people, military planners in Israel. But there are other ways. And we saw evidence of this in April when Iran fired over 300 projectiles
at Israel, and you saw this coalition of Arab states, Israel, the United States, European states come together and shoot down almost all those projectiles out of the sky. Now, what's interesting is that was entirely based upon diplomacy and partnership and security engagement with one's neighbors. And I think you saw there the hint, the kind of kernel of a very different approach to Israel addressing its legitimate security concerns. And the skeleton key to all of this is the Palestinian issue. If Israel meaningfully engaged with satisfying legitimate Palestinian rights to self-determination for an end to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, to be able to provide that level of security at Israel's closest borders, it would then unlock the ability for Israel to be at the core of this huge security network, right, of the strongest states from an intelligence and a military perspective in the region, plus, you know, NATO partners. And if you are genuinely fearful of Iran, and there's a lot to be fearful of there, that would be this kind of steel web of security. But it's not on offer unless the Palestinian issue is sincerely engaged with. And I think anyone who cares about Israel's security and long-term viability needs to really confront this. And that is what needs to change.
We hear on and off about these ceasefire talks. We don't seem to ever hear any progress. We hear, oh, we're getting closer. And the situation in Gaza, as far as the humanitarian issues, are just becoming untenable. And yet the bombing is also happening there. How is this now operation in the West Bank, the bombardment continuing in Gaza, the humanitarian crisis, how does the ceasefire talk, does that even seem realistic at this point? Because it just seems so far away. And I would imagine that the longer it takes, the hostages, whoever is still alive, more danger than they already have been. We're hearing about polio now. Mm-hmm. There are some real concerns about how much longer they can survive. So where does this stand as far as any sort of potential ceasefire?
Well, this is one of the most frustrating aspects, because we had President Biden back in late May sort of declare that we had an agreement that Israel was party to that could have a ceasefire, this three-stage ceasefire, and the gradual return of all hostages, but a significant number in that first stage. And then we had Hamas announcing a few weeks later that they accepted a version of that deal. Now, there was a little bit of deception on Hamas's part and that they had changed a couple of details, but trusted actors I spoke to said that these gaps were bridgeable. And then I think what you saw since then is the goalposts being moved, where additional conditions were inserted by Israel. And again, each one of which may be justifiable on for security reasons, but each one of which complicates and lengthens the process by which we can actually get to a deal. And you, as you said, every day that we wait, the conditions in Gaza grow worse. I mean, we now have this polio outbreak, and obviously the hostages themselves, we have no idea what state they're in and how close to death some of them may be. Indeed, some of whom may have died in the time between that initial negotiation phase and now. So it is very frustrating. And I would say there's a real onus on the international community here as well. Ultimately, there has been intense shuttle diplomacy led by the United States, very, very intense engagement from Egypt and Qatar. All of those three parties have different forms of influence and leverage with both Israel and with Hamas. And I feel that there must be something that can be done to induce a closing of these gaps now at this point. Because I feel like even hearing from Israeli negotiators who are speaking, they're leaking every day, essentially, very empowered individuals who are party to all of the details in the negotiations. And it's almost like a hostage video. They're appealing to these are Israeli diplomats and security officials briefing the media and really essentially appealing to the Biden administration to do something, to push their prime minister towards concluding a deal and securing the return of the hostages. And we've seen Defense Minister Gallant in Israel doing something very similar from within the cabinet. There was a vote this week on Israel having a permanent presence at the Philadelphia corridor, which is the corridor separating Egypt and the Gaza Strip. And the Defense Minister of Israel voted against the position, right? The person representing the IDF with the most level of expertise and the most direct responsibility for Israel's security, basically disagreeing with the prime minister and saying, no, if we make this demand, and we will not get a deal, and the hostages will die. And I think sometimes from a distance, that nuance isn't being seen. And you can see that the people who really understand both Israel's security needs, what it can and cannot manage and take, and who are sincerely concerned for the fate of the hostages, they are appealing to their own prime minister and the international community to try and force this deal through.
You know, a lot of people, obviously, in that part of the world, some of them personally. I know you know some of the families of the hostages. Mm-hmm. How are they coping at this point?
They're incredibly angry, distraught.
distraught, disappointed. I mean, can you imagine living with that level of emotional intensity and fragility every day for, what are we, 320 something days now? I mean, it's very, very hard to put yourself in somebody's shoes where it's a life and death kind of high intensity moment every moment for the best part of a year. And I think you're seeing this not only like, you know, what they're conveying privately and their public statements. They have become essentially activists. I'm generalizing, but very, very many every weekend being out in the streets in Tel Aviv demanding this deal. I mean, we saw the parents of Hirsch at the Democratic National Convention last week and making an incredibly moving appeal for a ceasefire deal and for the return of the hostages. And I thought as well, empathizing very much with the Palestinian victims in Gaza. And I think what you see there is a level of empathy and humanity that's really missing from the political leadership. And, you know, I have to hope that some of those messages are resonating and coming through with international leaders, because I think if this last opportunity, and that was the terms that's been put in by Israeli officials this week, that this is the last chance to get this deal. If that opportunity is missed and the loved ones of these Israeli citizens and internationals as well, we must remember, are essentially left to die, that legacy is going to be with us for a very long time. That doesn't go away. That will be within Israel a political fixed point in reality for generations, that an opportunity to save those lives was squandered. And I think that those who are making these life and death decisions should be really taking that into account as well.
John Linden, Executive Director with the Alliance for Middle East Peace. I always appreciate speaking to you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Laurie.
You're listening to Issues in the News. I'm Lori London. We've been hearing about the grave concerns for hostages still being held in Gaza. It's a strategy autocratic and terror group leaders use for leverage and to suppress opposition. And silencing a free press is a major component. On August 1st, a historic prisoner swap freed three Americans imprisoned in Russia. And this week, while in Washington, newly freed Radio Free Europe journalist Alsu Kermasheva, one of the two American journalists released in the exchange, sat down with VOA's Liam Scott.
It's the moment Alsu Kermasheva had dreamed of for months. An emotional reunion with her family at Joint Base Andrews outside Washington after more than 9 months of wrongful detention in Russia.
I was greeted by the president and by vice president, and it was such an honor for me, but everything I could see was my daughters.
A journalist for VOA sister outlet Radio Free Europe Radio Liberty in Prague, Kermasheva was convicted in a secret trial on charges of spreading false information about the Russian military.
I was jailed for 288 days, and every minute of it is suffering. It's going through humiliation, and inmates in Russia and Belarus, they don't have any rights.
Freed as part of a historic prisoner swap on August 1st, Kermasheva traveled first to a military base in Texas and then to her home in Prague to recover.
I want to enjoy my life from now on.
Back in Prague, finally setting foot in her family's apartment was overwhelming, she said.
I cried. I cried for the first time since many days. I knew I would cry because it meant a lot. It was such a happy cry. I still can't stop hugging my children.
Kermasheva's case is part of Moscow's wider crackdown on independent media. She was one of two American journalists the United States says were wrongfully detained in Russia. Like Kermasheva, Wall Street Journal reporter Evan Gershkovich was detained and convicted in a sham trial before also being released in the swap. Learning that Gershkovich would walk free was emotional for Paul Beckett, who led the journal's campaign to secure the reporter's release.
Tears of relief, smiles of joy. Hard to fully comprehend. I think it's probably still a bit hard to fully comprehend. But yeah, just a moment of an enormous weight lifted. And all of the effort felt like at that moment it paid off.
Gershkovich is doing well, despite having spent around 500 days in prison, Beckett says.
It's just amazing to get a life started, restarted. So that's what we've been focused on. I think he's taking time to decompress and just find his feet again.
The cases of Gershkovich and Kermasheva highlight the Russian government's harsh crackdown on independent journalism.
And journalists are afraid to seek independent sources of information because all those sources have been banned or have been designated illegal in Russia. The whole society and also media has been put on survival mode.
Now reunited with her family, Kermasheva says she wants to turn her attention to political prisoners still jailed, including three of her colleagues at RFERL. Liam Scott, VOA News.
And now here with us is VOA Press Freedom editor Jessica Jarit with details on how her team is working to shed light on the increasing threats journalists are facing around the world.
It just seems like every day we're hearing another story about another journalist either being jailed or being killed. And of course, this week alone, we've got protests in Iraq over a drone strike that killed two journalists. We've got the junta in Myanmar that have killed two journalists. And also this week, a member of the Reuters news agency killed when a missile hit the hotel where he was staying. It just seems like journalists across the world are really now in life-threatening situations more than ever.
Yes, Laurie, that's certainly the case. I think journalism has never been as dangerous a profession as it is today. Some of the cases you mentioned, I think, really tie in with a lot of conflicts that are happening right now. In Myanmar, where they've had civil war since the coup in 2021, media have come under fire right from the start, mostly with jailings. But in this case, two journalists who were reporting on the resistance movement were killed when 30 armed men raided their home. They were speaking to two resistance fighters at the time, four people killed. And the case that you mentioned Saturday in eastern Ukraine, Ryan Evans, he's a safety advisor with Reuters, was sadly killed when there was a Russian strike on a hotel known as a base for aid workers and journalists. Ryan was there as part of a six-member media crew. Two other Reuters journalists are seriously injured and being treated for their injuries. This kind of targeting just really, it makes it even harder at a time when we need our journalists on the front line to explain what's happening with these conflicts and the toll to civilians. We are becoming more and more targeted and putting our lives at risk, and it's a real sad state and a loss, I think, for the whole journalism community when we have these cases.
And we had at least a good news story recently with the release of several American journalists, among others, from Russia in the prisoner exchange. One of them was American-Russian journalist Alsu Kermasheva. And VOA Press Freedom team had a chance to speak with her and talk about how she's adjusting to life here. How did this come about? And this wasn't just talking about her release and the excitement of that. This is something that the team has been heavily engaged in for quite a while, is this issue.
Yes, and as you say, I mean, it is a rare good news day for Press Freedom, the historic prisoner swap. I think what's sort of unique about this case is at VOA, we have a Press Freedom desk, so we cover these issues all the time. So we're not just there for the case of a journalist being arrested or released. Well, we cover those. We cover everything in between. And particularly with Alsu Kermasheva and the Wall Street Journal reporter Evan Gershkovich, we've worked very closely with their friends, with their colleagues, the people involved in this immense campaign to try to secure this historic release. And it's really opened up our eyes to the burden that are placed on families when an American is taken hostage. And we see authoritarian governments do that more and more. But just the resolve and the community that comes around to support people during this time and to keep reminding the world that Alsu and Evan were jailed for nothing more than being a journalist and for being Americans. It's been a very sort of powerful story to tell. It's been on a personal level for the whole team, just getting to know Alsu's family. She has two young daughters, Bibi and Miriam, who have been out and very vocal speaking out about their mother's case in the past year. And it's just been to see that moment. We were there on the tarmac when they landed, and it was just this overwhelming moment of seeing all of the good that journalism can do in reporting, in explaining these issues, explaining how Russians are using hostage taking as a tactic, and to see that the power of advocacy and US foreign policy can bring our Americans safely home.
VOA Press Freedom editor Jessica Jarit, thank you so much. And that is all the time we have this week. On behalf of all of us here at VOA, we thank you so much for listening. For more news throughout the week, listen to International Edition Monday through Friday, or visit us anytime at voanews.com. Join us next week for more Issues in the News. Until then, I'm Lori London.